Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. This is J.R. Moore and my friend Randy Taylor coming to you from, at least I am, coming to you from deep in the mountains of Missouri Ozarks on Friday, the 10th day of January, year of our Lord 2025. Welcome to the Doug Hagman Report here. And for the next 2 hours, Randy and I will cover the events today with commentary and our thoughts on what's going on, why things are going on, how they're going on, things that you need to be making note of so that you can be informed to make the proper decisions you need to be making to make sure you and your family is safe. Good evening, Randy.
Yes, sir.
Well, as I said earlier, if I felt any better, it wouldn't be legal.
So, that's a great answer. That's a great answer, yeah, though, John.
People
I love
know how to respond to that. Randy's coming from the beautiful country of Canada. I've only spent very little time in Canada. Impressed me as a very clean country, by the way. And, of course, I'm down here in the Missouri Ozarks. Well, my friend Steve Quayle, I started interviewing Steve Quayle on my first radio show back in the late 1970s, around 77, 78. And this first headline at Steve Quayle's website right now as we speak, here it is. Bombshell report, incompetent L.A. Mayor Bass took 15 trips to Cuba when she was a teenager. There she trained as a radical alongside future members of M19 and the Weather Underground, two domestic terror groups and terrorist tactics. Now, back in those days, you couldn't travel. It was illegal to travel to Cuba, Randy, and this shows me her what this little article, and it's just the headline. I haven't read the whole article. Shows me her very bona fide communist credentials. Does that show you the same thing, Randy?
Shows me exactly the same thing. And I know for a long time you could not go to Cuba.
No,
it wasn't until recently, I think under Obama, that they lifted that travel restriction.
Right.
Of course, Obama would lift it.
Of course. Well, he's another communist.
Absolutely, with a lot of those same credentials, John.
Now, moving down the line of headlines here at Quayle's website, another thing involving Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass. She demanded her fire department cut another $49 million from their budget 1 week before the wildfire started. Now, this memo is dated January 6th, the day before the devastating Palisades fire started. Now, earlier this year, she cut $17.6 million from the fire department budget. She gave away and shipped fire department equipment from Los Angeles to Ukraine. Now, I can't put this on Mayor Bass, but I was watching an interview, Randy, with a California state rep. He may have been a state senator, but I think he's a state rep. He said that 10 years ago, the California legislature passed and the governor signed a bill to pay for 10 new water reservoirs for Los Angeles. 10 years ago. They have tried and tried again to get the building permits issued to build the reservoirs, but they have not been issued for 10 years. Now, my wife tells me that the money was spent. That's why they didn't issue the building permits. They spent it on something else, probably illegal aliens.
California's got a list of crap that they spend things on that any other state would not do.
Of course not. Of course not. That's a given. And I'm truly amazed at the I don't know if I would qualify California as the most beautiful state in the country, but certainly right up there with Florida as one of the most beautiful states, beautiful climate, beautiful people. It has all the natural resources to be a freestanding country if it chose to be so, as it was back in the 1840s, a freestanding republic. But why?
It's got one of the highest GDPs in the world.
Yes, but that's going down. Incrementally.
Yep,
you're
that's
right.
That's dropping like a stone.
It is. Out of the several hundred thousand jobs created the past year, I believe 5,000 of them were in the private sector. That's a very telling number right there. But California is a good example of what's happened to a smaller extent all over the country, where the conservative Christian patriots have been busy with their families, their careers, their church, and let the communists like Mayor Bass take office, become mayors, city council members, get on these hospital boards, library boards, become sheriff. We have a sheriff in Michigan who is going to save the planet by putting two deputies in every car instead of one. And she just announced that yesterday.
Yeah.
but we being the conservative Christian patriots, we've been asleep at the wheel, taking care of private personal business instead of minding the shop where these communists have taken over. And when it comes to California, they've pretty much got the whole shebang, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Eric, I just sent you a picture of the reservoir that was supposed to be filled with 117 million gallons of water. And that was for the Palisades. They said the reason it was empty, there's two different stories. One, because of a small fish. And then the other story, look at that. Look at that. That is 117 million capacity empty. And they're saying, oh, well, we were doing repairs.
Right, right.
Uh-huh. That's amazing.
Repairs for how long?
That is irresponsible. You know what? We're talking currently between 9,000 and 10,000 structures. That's devastating.
The number I'm hearing is 10,000. It's probably going to be much more before it's over. Now, I haven't heard a report, Randy, maybe you have, in the last 24 hours, of any percentage of containment. The last I heard was 0% containment. Have you any updates on that?
They said earlier today that they feel they've turned the corner on the fire, but that looked like it was maybe one person's opinion, John. I wouldn't go as far as to publish it and say that's the case. He didn't even sound too sure of what he was saying. Sounded more like
that's a rather nebulous statement. It's not giving a percentage of containment, is it?
No, not at all.
It's like grabbing a handful of smoke. We don't know what the percentage is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, the insurance companies pulled out of there 2 weeks ago, the mayor was warned that we had an extreme fire hazard. But she went to Africa for anyway, didn't she?
They said that the insurance companies started like as much as 2 years ago, canceling policies and doing non-renewal on policies because they had been told by the state, whatever the insurance commission is, they couldn't raise the rates. So they just started canceling, and it's been crazy.
Well, of course not. They're in business to make money. They
absolutely
have minimal risk.
Absolutely.
And as the risk goes up, the premiums go up. That's just the way the insurance industry works.
Yes, sir.
I know about a couple of years ago, I turned 75. My life insurance premiums doubled because that's the average age a man dies in this country is 75. And I'm self-insured, so I wasn't too concerned about that. But that's the way insurance companies work. They look at the risk and they base their rates based on the risk that they're facing.
Oh, yeah.
Which brings up another thing related to insurance, life insurance in particular. The life insurance industry has seen a 20% increase in all-cause morbidity. Now, I don't know if they were told to do this, but what they're doing is spreading out the risk between not only the life insurance policyholders, but health insurance, car insurance, homeowners insurance, so that it doesn't look so bad. Because if they just kept the risk to where it should be for life insurance, a 20% increase in all-cause morbidity, two things would happen. The premiums would go up dramatically and would scare the hell out of people, which it should.
Yes.
You know, Randy, we've been through the worst war as far as American casualties was the Civil War because everybody that died was an American.
Mm-hmm.
We went through other wars, the First World War, Second World War, the Spanish flu in 1918. And nothing came close to a 20% increase in all-cause morbidity.
Yep.
Now, Randy, in my county, I live in Crawford County, Missouri, we have three funeral homes. And actually, there's two in Crawford. There's four in Crawford County. Two of them are owned by the same family. I've interviewed employees at three of these places. And they say, John, we've had a 100% increase in our clients. And dead people coming in the door since the COVID vaccination was released.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't surprise me, John.
The one employee, she held up the calendar with all the funerals listed on it. She says, if you looked at this calendar 3 years ago, it'd be mostly empty spaces. now every day is taken up with a funeral.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that there was an increase. I didn't know it was that dramatic. And I look at the local obituaries. I look at two things. I look at the person, and I look at their age when they died, especially if they died under the age of 75. And what I'm seeing in the local newspaper obituaries is about half the people are under the age of 75,
mm-hmm.
which is another scary thing.
Yeah.
So this is my mantra that I've been focusing on now since January 2020. Randy, I was on my first Caribbean cruise, probably my only one, because I don't want to be on a boat with a bunch of vaccinated people. But I'm on my first Caribbean cruise with about 15, 16 of my listeners. And during breaks, I was going to watch the news. And there was these videos coming out of China where a man would be walking down the street. He fall down face first, bleed out, and die from what they called coronavirus at the time, which is now called COVID-19. It was scary. And I started looking at, you know, what I do when I get home, what precautions I would take, and so forth. And I looked at the same videos about 8 months later, 9 months later, and I looked at them more carefully. The man falling down face first was a world-class athlete. He had the ability to hold his hands out below his waist and catch his body weight,
right,
so his face didn't hit the concrete with full force. It very gently touched the concrete.
Yeah.
It takes a top athlete to be able to do that, in case you don't know, ladies and gentlemen. A really top athlete. I could have did it maybe 30 years ago, but there's no way I could now. And so that was a fraud. They had also at the same time videos of Chinese authorities welding the doors and windows shut.
I remember that.
Apartment buildings where people had coronavirus. The videos of authorities making roadblocks so people couldn't go in or out of certain villages.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was very scary. And it was meant to be scary. And the whole thing was a fraud.
Yep.
Now, Randy, I do.
That was a huge, huge psyop, John.
It was. Well, I spent a year in psychological operations in Vietnam and another 3 years in psychological operations in the Army Reserve. So I know a little bit about the topic. As an intelligence analyst, I know a lot about the topic. And more than the average guy or gal might know. But I started to mention, Randy, I do private consultations, and I do them in person. I do them on the telephone. I do Zoom conference calls. So I had two doctors come here for private consultation from the East Coast, and they spent a whole day with me. It was a great day, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. They told me one of their patients works for one of the three vaccine manufacturers. They didn't tell me which one. I didn't ask to protect this person's identity. And here's what this patient told them. That her company had worked on the vaccines for 6 years. The COVID vaccines were worked on for 6 years before we ever knew there was a COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how can you have a vaccine for something that doesn't exist, Randy? How is that even possible?
That's a good question, but I heard the same thing up here in Canada.
Well, it's true.
I heard reports, and it was from government people I knew that were in the government. And there were things already in place before we knew anything about it.
Obviously. Obviously.
Well, it was a well-orchestrated hoax all around the
world. It was. Now, there's something called TED Talks, TED.
Yep.
And Bill Gates, I don't know if he's given more than one, but the one TED Talk he gave, and I got on my website at thelibertyman.com, he is proud and brags about reducing the world's population with vaccines.
Yep.
And I tell it to him, like my kid brother, he got a vaccine known to mankind, and he will continue to. He doesn't believe it's true. It's not true. It can't be true. Well, it is true. It's not some computer-generated image. It's Bill Gates really saying that. If Bill Gates didn't say that, he would probably file a lawsuit to have it taken off the internet, you know, really quick, I would imagine. Yep. But he's proud of it. Why would he take it down?
He's absolutely proud of it, and he comes right out and says it. And it's almost the statement that he makes is so it's like ironic. It's like irony.
I know.
You know, when he says it, you know, you'd almost question it. But that's what the man said, plain and simple. And like you said, he hasn't told anybody to take it down.
It's been about 3 years ago, I mailed my daughter the CD, the documentary Vaxxed with two X's, V-A-X-X-E-D, hoping that would convince her to In fact, that was before the COVID vaccine even came out. Convince her to think twice about getting a COVID vaccine, but it didn't work. My daughter, her husband, my two youngest grandchildren, who are both freshmen in college right now, all four of them got the COVID clot shot, as I call it, and at least three boosters that I know of. They're probably continuing to get boosters. So far, knock on wood, they're healthy. But in my opinion, it's probably just a matter of time before the ugly head of the COVID vaccines raises out of the muck to cause harm to these four individuals. Mm-hmm. It's when I refer to it as the worst crime in human history, that's exactly what it is, Randy.
That was genocide, John.
It is. I'm not sure if it's genocide or panicide, but Mao Zedong held the record previously for murdering 50 million of his own people. Mm-hmm. That number is going to be doubled or tripled or quadrupled before it's over, yes, unfortunately.
Yes, it will.
Now, there's a bonus. The bonus is the bird flu vaccine. That's coming. That's coming like a train down, coming downhill with no brakes. I mean, there's nothing going to stop this bird flu vaccine.
It's coming at us. It's coming at us. Yep.
And you either jump out of the way or you get run over. And that's your two choices.
Yep.
But once again, people roll up their sleeves. They will maybe pay a slight bribe to get in line first ahead of everybody else, which we saw that happen. I predicted it would happen, and it did. That will be the real kill shot.
Mm-hmm.
I firmly believe that the COVID vaccine is a kill shot, but I don't believe it's killing fast enough to suit them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Randy, you've heard of the Deagle report, haven't you?
Yeah.
Now, Deagle is a private intelligence service,
yeah.
Similar to RAND Corporation. I used to read the RAND Corporation's classified reports every week in Vietnam.
Yep.
And it's a private intelligence service that Fortune 500 companies and big banks, anybody who can afford it, they pay for the information that comes from Deagle.
Yeah.
And if the information from Deagle was not reliable, not true, something that couldn't be counted on, well, Deagle would be out of business, wouldn't they?
They would absolutely be out of business.
But they're not. They're in business. And the Deagle report was on the internet free and open for several years. It's been taken down, but there's still, it's on my website. You can still see it.
I remember reading it.
And here we are. 2025 is the year. Mm-hmm. The year that Deagle says more than half of all Americans will be dead by the end of this year. Now, we're about almost halfway through the first month of the year. And it's going to be an interesting 52 weeks, isn't it?
It'll be very interesting. And this bird flu, it's going to be interesting to see how people deal with it. I was reading just after a couple doctors on the internet, and they were saying, and they were really trying to get the word out, there's nothing novel about this bird flu. Nothing.
Bird flu's been around for decades. There's nothing new about the bird flu.
Yeah, they said it was 300 or 400 years old.
We have one case of one human being in the United States dying from it, which we don't know the details of that. No case whatsoever of bird flu being transmitted from one human being to another human being.
Yep.
Apparently that can't happen. But they're going to blow this thing out of proportion just like they did with COVID.
Oh, yeah.
And we can count on it. And the PSYOPs, I'll give you an example that I observed myself. In the middle of the pandemic, I live two counties away from St. Louis County. St. Louis County is St. Louis City and St. Louis County is 2.5 million people. It's the largest metropolitan area near me, largest one in Missouri.
I used to live there.
Okay. Well, I was coming home one evening from an appointment. I decided to stop at a clothing store. It was probably 8:30. Closing time was 9 o'clock. It was cold. It was really cold. But I went in there and I thought, well, I'm going to see what happens if I don't wear a mask. So I went in there with probably five women employees, maybe a guy who was a manager. And the moment I walked in there, they were looking at me like I was some kind of armed robber. There was the fear in these people's eyes.
Yeah.
It was just so apparent. These mm-hmm. people were fearful of a man just walking in the store to look at some clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I'll see where this goes. And I made my choices of, I think I picked out a tracksuit that looked good and with my size. And so I walk up to the cash register. none of the women would come to the cash register. So the manager comes to the cash register and says, sir, you need to leave. And I said, you're not going to check me out? He says, no, I'm not going to check you out. I said, okay. And I walked out the door. They wouldn't serve me. They wouldn't sell me the tracksuit.
I remember during COVID going to a casino, and you had to wait outside. So I waited outside, and that's back when I used to smoke. And I remember going over to the pavilion, and I was going to stand there for a minute, and there was this guy in the pavilion, and I walked in. I'm not wearing a mask, and I'm outside. And this guy flipped. He flipped. He ran in and got security and everything. It was bananas. And with that terror that you're talking about, he was terrified because I didn't have a mask on and I was close to him in a pavilion with him.
I know.
And it made me sick is what it made me. That they had terrified people to that point.
They had.
That's horrific.
No,
that's criminal.
The same winter. This would be the winter of 2021, that winter. Once again, I'm in St. Louis County. There's a sport where people pay money to throw tomahawks at a target. And so I've never been to one of these places before. I thought, well, this would be fun. I got my girlfriend with me. It's probably 7 o'clock in the evening. The young man working there was also a student at St. Louis University Medical School, which is a world-class school of medicine for people to become doctors. So we're talking, and he says, well, John, a couple of my classmates, now we're talking young men, 25, 26, 27 years old. Some of my classmates are in the Missouri National Guard medical unit, and they got the task of taking COVID tests, testing people for COVID with these long swabs that they put up the nose all the way up to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So being 25-year-olds, they thought, well, let's have some fun with this. Let's take 300 of these swabs that have never touched a human being and send them back for analysis. And they did that. They sent 300 swabs back to the testing laboratory to find out what the results would be.
Let me guess.
All 300 came back positive.
Absolutely.
Now,
absolutely.
There's only two ways that could happen. There's not a third way. One way is they were faking the results. The second way is the swabs already had the COVID virus on them when nobody ever touched them. There's no third option, is there, Randy?
I can think of, no.
No, of course there's not. And I'm convinced. I'm absolutely convinced that these swabs did have COVID on them, that people that went for this testing were actually given, quote, COVID by the swabs. I don't believe that the laboratory was faking the test. I really don't believe that. I believe the tests actually went the way they normally do. Normal testing with normal results.
It could be. I also think that sometimes regular flu and colds and things like that show up as COVID.
Pandemic, I don't know if they're still doing that, but the state of Washington publicly admitted that every gunshot death was listed as a COVID death.
They
admitted that a couple of years ago.
Yeah, we had the same thing. People falling off ladders. COVID. Really?
Right.
Really? It's almost like they were getting a bounty on COVID deaths.
Well, I know the current coroner and the former coroner of my county. I'm friends with the recently replaced coroner in a nearby county, Texas County. The coroner of my county spends time with his assistants going over death certificates and talking to the healthcare professionals to make, and I'm not sure if they're still doing it, but for the last 3 years I did make sure that somebody who died from COVID on the death certificate actually did die from COVID on the death certificate. And trying to make sure that these statistics are actually accurate and reliable as opposed to make believe.
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few of them, especially residents from my county who die in St. Louis County, two counties away, he found a lot of them with fraudulent death certificates.
I'm going to tell you the truth, John, and this was even being in and out of Canada during COVID. I never knew a single person that died from COVID.
Right.
And I mean that, and I'm saying that, I give you my word. I never did. I'll tell you another thing. The local hospital in the town in Canada, I had a doctor's appointment in that hospital. I went to the doctor's appointment, and on purpose, I went to the emergency room. Right. And these overflowing emergency rooms, people sleeping in the hallways and all that.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
it was bullshit. John, it was, I swear to God, there was nothing going on in the emergency room. Nothing, John.
When it was allegedly the worst part of the pandemic.
Oh, my God. You used to hear it on the news? It was insane. And I'm sitting here and I'm going, where are they filming this at? I mean, they must be putting it in the room.
Well, actually, there was a hospital in Italy that ended up being one of those videos.
Wow. You know what it reminded me of? Pallywood, the Palestinians. When they they do their shows against the Israelis, that's exactly what it reminded me of. And I thought, what has gone so wrong that our medical doctors, who take an oath, would participate in this? Where have we gone so wrong?
The first week that a medical student comes into medical school, doesn't matter which one, they're told to only pay attention to information from the medical school and the FDA and the Center for Disease Control. Anything else is not to be looked at, not to be respected, not to be thought well of, and should be rejected out of hand. That's what they're taught. Right.
That's why you and I are not doctors, Sean.
Well, there's other reasons why I'm not a doctor.
That's one of them, though.
I never had a goal to be a doctor. At one time, I thought I might want to be an attorney. I got my degree as a paralegal, thinking, well, I'll check out this legal thing. And even before I graduated, I replaced an attorney who moved on to a different job at the same job, at the same desk, doing the exact same work for half the pay, with the American Optometric Association. And the lawyer I worked with, a great guy, we're still friends. I thought, no, I can't spend the rest of my life doing this. There's no way. It was. it gets better. The American Optometric Association was the subject of the classic antitrust lawsuit. It's taught in law schools all over the country as the classic antitrust lawsuit. The United States government versus the American Optometric Association and the Georgia Optometric Association, who are allegedly colluding to engage in controlling prices and so forth.
Yes.
We have something called interrogatories when it comes to a lawsuit. And we had, I think, a 70-question interrogatory. I got my very own interrogatory, just for me. And here was my interrogatory. Produce all – listen carefully, Randy. Okay. This is really fun. All right. Produce all correspondence between the Georgia Optometric Association and the American Optometric Association from 1898 to present, which the present was 1972. Well, the building we were in had four levels. Each level had about 5,000 square feet. Two levels were below ground. There was a basement and a sub-basement. The sub-basement was all five-drawer file cabinets. That's where I spent the entire winter of 1972-73, going through every piece of paper from 1898 to present.
Oh, man.
Recovering documents. So about halfway through that, I called this professor. He was one of my instructors. He's becoming a paralegal. And I said, man, I need to get out of here. You know, he says he knew me pretty well. He was also an instructor at St. Louis University Law School. He says, John, you ever think about being an investigator? And I said, no, I never thought about it. He says, let's have lunch. So we had lunch and we talked, and he agreed to introduce me to the largest private detective firm in Metro St. Louis. So I met these guys. They tried me out. So my first day on the job, it's sunny. There's fresh air. My surveillance vehicle, this is really fun, is a red Jaguar XK150.
That doesn't stick out.
Not at all. They had been specially modified. The engine had been gone through with very special modifications. That sucker would really go. But I'm thinking to myself, this is great. I got fresh air. I got sunshine. I'm not in the, in the basement, below the basement. I can do this. So I gave my 2 weeks notice, and I start my training. The guy I was training with, this private detective who was almost old enough to be my father, he was driving the exact same car that a TV detective was driving, a green Camaro. And I forget the name of the he was playing this role, who was a convicted felon who had become a detective, a private investigator. And I was thinking to myself, man, this is great. I'm just like this TV guy. I'm out here in this green Camaro doing this investigative work.
Like Rockford
Rockford
Files?
Rockford
yeah.
was the
yeah.
guy.
One
yeah.
of my, hero, one of my heroes growing up, yeah.
Yeah, Rockford, the green Camaro. Yeah. I thought, this is great. I'm with Rockford. So I spent 3 months training. I had my first undercover job. I've had a number of undercover jobs in different situations, a couple of bodyguard assignments. And then we had something called the Saturday Night Massacre, where President Nixon ordered the attorney general to fire the special counsel that was investigating him. So the attorney general refused the president's order and resigned. The guy took his place. President Nixon ordered him to fire the special counsel, and he refused the order and resigned. Now we got to the third guy in the chain of command, Department of Justice, and he took the president's order and fired the special counsel investigating President Nixon over Watergate. Well, that was Saturday, and I got a call Saturday night from a friend of mine who was a former prosecuting attorney. He says, John, I want to bring a friend up. I was living in downtown St. Louis, the Soulard area. We want to talk about what happened last night. And I said, sure, well, I'll make the coffee. You bring the donuts. Well, the guy he brought with him was a public defender, a guy not much older than myself, another Vietnam vet. So we talked about the events of what happened with the Saturday Night Massacre and whether U.S. Marshals would be in every building in Washington, D.C. Monday morning or not. That was the speculation at the very highest levels, quite frankly, over that incident. But during that conversation, the coffee and donuts, I was offered to interview to be the homicide detective for the public defender, one county south of me. And I agreed to interview. So I go down there and interview with the public defender, his assistant, who was a bona fide World War II hero. He personally sunk a Japanese warship by himself, putting a bomb down the smokestack from his fighter. And they call me up 2 weeks later, and they say, John, we interviewed a dozen people. You're the only guy who even has a clue what this job entails. If you want the job, it's yours.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, I'll take the job. And so after I accept the job, I said, oh, by the way, we can't pay enough money to live on, so you need to do investigative work on the side to make ends meet. Oh, well, I can do that. And that's how this whole thing got started. That was the fall of 1973.
Wow.
September 1990. I got my first double homicide a couple of weeks later, the second week of September 1973. And he was a bona fide nutcase. We don't have many psychos, really, in the world of people doing murders, but this guy was a real psycho.
Yeah.
And He murdered two young people just for the pleasure of doing it. He had three goals in life. One was to jump off an airplane. He joined the Army, lasted 2 weeks before they kicked him out. The other was to make love to a woman. He had never done that. He's 18 years old. And a third was to murder somebody. That's the only thing he accomplished.
Wow.
And he's ever since then, he's been locked up in more than 50 years in the psychiatric ward of the Missouri State Hospital, where they keep the criminally insane.
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite happy with himself and his life. Life goes on, as I say. We didn't have a death penalty back then.
That is sad.
It is sad. Well, my job, he grew up in Kentucky in a coal mining town. And I was given the assignment to go there and interview everybody, his entire family and everybody from his kindergarten teacher on up, which I did.
Did they know that there was something wrong with the guy, or?
Yeah, when he was a young teenager, I think 13 years old, the police arrested him on the roof of the junior high school with several weapons. So, and even earlier than that, when he was 3 or 4 years old, he was stopped walking through the house holding a knife, saying, "Kill Mikey, kill Mikey." Mikey was one of his brothers. So there was mental issues with this boy from the get-go. No surprise.
Wow.
No surprise. And he just slipped through the system, which brings up a topic I think we should address, Randy. I think it's related to all this, is why we have all the murders and mass killings we have now, why we didn't have them 50-plus years ago. AR-15s have been available for more than 50 years.
Yep.
Over the counter. Not a problem. Now, before 1968, you could buy the equivalent of an AR-15 through the mail. All you had to do is fill out a coupon saying you were 18 years or older and send that with your money order, and your rifle or pistol would be shipped to you through the Postal Service.
Yep.
That's the way it used to be.
Yep.
And we had weapons just as powerful, just as accurate in 1968 and earlier as we do now. So what's the difference?
Well,
I'll tell you what the difference is, but go ahead.
If I just throw it in there, I'm going to say, one, we brought people in from other countries where the value on human life is not near, you know, how we value human life here in the United States. I think there's been breakdowns in the families. Parents used to raise their children. You used to meet at the dinner table. Now, you don't even know where the parents are. They're working, or they're doing this or doing that. You know, and they want to blame the government. Well, the school should have known something was wrong. Well, the school shooter. Well, the school should have known. No, mom and dad, you should have known something was wrong.
Well, those are all factors, and those factors are real and do have merit. But there's the real elephant in the living room. I'm going to tell you what it is right now. Around the period 1969-1970, the government and the mental health professionals reached a decision. We can save hundreds of millions of dollars, and instead of housing these people that are dangerous to themselves and others, we'll put them on meds and turn them loose, emptying out the insane asylums nationwide. Now, you looked at St. Louis. You may or may not have seen the State Hospital on Arsenal Street.
Mm-hmm.
At one time, when it was built, it was the world's largest building. It was specifically built to house the mentally insane. So instead of keeping people safe and in a clean, a healthy environment where they could do no harm, we turned the entire insane asylum loose on the street. Now, that instantly created the homeless problem.
Yep.
Almost all, and there may be some exceptions, but almost all homeless people are mentally ill.
Yes.
And there's no doubt about that. That's an easily provable fact and statistic.
Yep.
People that before 1969 would have been in a mental institution where they'd be cared for, they could not hurt themselves, not hurt others. Those are not fun places, on one hand. On the other, we didn't have mass shootings before 1969. Occasionally, there was the guy in the Texas Tower shooter. I think that was in the early 60s, around 62 or 63, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was such a very, very rare exception.
Yeah,
it was.
Yeah. And the problem
now
the problem we have with the people that we sent home, they're not taking their meds, and we have no way of ensuring that their meds will be taken.
No, there's not.
You know, there's no safeties, John.
No, there's not. So this is no secret among men who are old enough to remember that transition, such as myself. And, of course, most guys my age are now retiring from police work or medical work, whatever they might be doing, where they could talk firsthand about this change in our society that they observed firsthand, which I observed firsthand. And
John, you remember when you were a young man, the guys that had a pickup truck, they had a .22 in the rack.
Right.
You know, guys who came to my school, they had gun racks in their trucks. They had guns in the trucks.
Right.
There was never a shooting in my school. There was never an incident of a gun being, well, there was one. There was one. A black kid brought a .38 to school, and they found out about it really quick. Very fast. I mean, they had the cops in there in literally.
That's because he was showing it off.
Yeah,
that's why.
Exactly what happened. Somebody ratted him out, and next thing you knew, the police were on this kid. But I remember all my friends, you know, I remember going to parties on Friday nights, you know, the guys were drinking and having fun. Nobody pulled a rifle out of the rack and threatened anybody.
Of course not.
You didn't do that.
Of course not. Well, my high school guys were bringing rifles to work on their rifles and do a little work on them, maybe work on the stock, make a nice pretty mm-hmm. stock for it. That was routine. It was no big deal. Nobody thought anything about it.
Yep.
And out here where I am, I'm not sure what the rules are about a youngster having a deer rifle in their pickup during deer season. It most likely does happen because when school's out, that's a good time to be going hunting just before dark. And I don't want to tell everybody what the rules are and be wrong, but it's pretty common here in my neighborhood for 8-year-old boys and girls to get their first deer with a rifle or with a bow, either one. Typically, for a youngster, it'd be a rifle, a little bit older, a bow. And that's just a rite of passage. It's an expected thing
yep.
for 8-year-old and 9-year-old boys to harvest their first deer at that young age.
Yep.
It's normal. It's expected. It's a good thing.
It's a life lesson.
And, of course, now we have something. I do agree with it. We have a hunter safety course that all these youngsters have to take, mm-hmm. which has almost eliminated accidents with these firearms. And that's a good thing too, isn't it?
I remember deer hunting down in Potosi, Missouri. many times he's heading down to Potosi. I lived in South St. Louis County.
Right.
And deer season was in November. And that's what I would do in November. Every year I took the time off work, headed down to Potosi and grabbed a deer down there. I haven't deer hunted since I left Missouri, John.
Right. Well, that's Washington County and that's where my mother's folks come from, and I have grandparents buried in a cemetery in Washington County.
I loved it down there.
Including my grandfather, not my great-grandfather, my grandfather, who was born during the Abraham Lincoln administration. Yeah. And
I'm going to leave that one alone.
Well, he was 21 years old when Geronimo surrendered to the Army.
Oh.
Yeah.
Those are the days, eh?
And my great-grandfather, who I always knew he was in the Civil War, but I didn't know which side. Yeah, so I looked up his obituary. Unfortunately, he was on the wrong side. But he was drafted into the Union Army during the Civil War, just not long, less than a year before the war ended. I don't know what he saw or what he did. I haven't looked up his unit's heritage, what they were involved with. But I know the family, what the family thought about the Civil War, because his daughter, my grandmother, married Robert Lee Blunt, my grandfather. Now,
really?
Yeah. If you were named Robert Lee during the Civil War, there's no doubt about where your...
There better be some Southern connections there.
Your loyalty lied. I don't believe. Not at all. But there's still
cool.
a lot...
That's cool.
In my part of Crawford County, there's still a lot of pro-Confederate sentiment down here. I would say a good percentage of the homes fly the stars and bars in front of their home. And it's not there for decoration. It's part of their sentiment as being free Americans who are standing up for their rights, which is what's going on in the Civil War. I don't want to go too deep into that, but most people, when they learn about the Civil War in school, are not taught what really happened.
No.
They simply aren't.
The simple thing that they're thrown out there is it was all about slavery, and that's not true.
Well, both countries had slavery during the Civil War, and yes, when Abraham Lincoln... Civil War, slavery was legal in the United States, and when the moment that Abraham Lincoln's heart stopped beating from that bullet, slavery was still legal in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't free the slaves.
No,
the Emancipation Proclamation did not free the slaves in the United States of America. It attempted to free the slaves in conquered territory. Mm-hmm. That's all it did. That's all it did.
Yep.
It took the 14th Amendment, which didn't come into effect until after Abraham Lincoln was long cold in his grave, to actually free the slaves. And all during the Civil War, there was 5 states that had slavery legal in the United States all during the Civil War.
Yep.
So slavery was, yes.
The Civil War was the result of an overbearing government. Washington, D.C.
A large part of what was going on with the Civil War was where the tax revenue was going. the South was a tax revenue machine for the whole country. So the money is being collected from the South, going to the North for projects in the North, and almost none of it being spent in the South. And the Southern states finally had enough of that. They said, why the hell are we paying all these taxes? None of it ever comes back here for our roads, our bridges, our dams, our post offices that we need. It's all being spent up North.
And where else did that sound familiar? It sounded like the Revolutionary War, the taxation without representation.
Well, they had representation, but they were outnumbered.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading a thing where the tea tax or whatever they did, they went, it was like 2%.
That's,
and they're ready to go to war over it. And I look at what have we put up with today, you know, out of the government. And it's amazing. They did things differently back then, John.
Well, they did.
Yep.
I ran for Congress in the 1996 cycle against Dick Gephardt in the 3rd Congressional District. And in my research, when I was running for Congress, I determined how much money is spent on taxes at every point in our society. And it comes up, you know, you look at shoes or houses or cars or coats you wear, paint for your house, whatever it might be, food, doesn't matter. About half of everything we spend is spent on taxes, hidden taxes that are added at every point of the way. Let's
yes, sir.
You know, it's insidious. The way they do it to collect these taxes is absolutely insidious, and it's pretty much hidden from the average person. They only see it when you go to the grocery store and you buy a can of pork and beans, they see the tax added on then, but that's all they think about. Mm-hmm. Or if you buy an automobile, there's that tax, which is a pretty hefty tax, by the way. But they're not aware of all these other taxes that are hidden in everything, every aspect of life. Oh. It's a massive money-grabbing scheme, isn't it, Randy?
Yes, sir, it is. If you ever want to see taxes really out of control, take a look at your cell phone bill.
Well, there's a tax there, the federal tax, which was implemented to help pay for the Vietnam War. I expect it'll be there forever to pay for the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War has been over since 1975, and that tax is not going to go away, and hardly anybody knows why it's there in the first place, do they?
That's crazy. That's crazy, John.
It is, but that's a fact of life.
Yeah.
Well, let's do a segue here to President Trump. He takes office in less than 2 weeks on the Monday, the 20th. His appointments are driving I refer to our opposition as the socialists, communists, Democrats, Muslims, is driving them absolutely crazy, which I'm glad. If they're not saying anything, that means it's a so-so appointment. But Cash Patel, Hegseth, and others, Bobby Kennedy Jr., if you want to dismantle the deep state, he's picking the right guys to do that, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yes, he is.
And
you can tell by the panic that hit when he started naming people he hadn't even really pushed for the appointment yet, like Gates and people like that. The panic buttons went off everywhere, alarms everywhere. And that right there tells you you're doing the right thing.
That's right. Now, I expect Donald Trump to do as much as he can in 4 years, which won't be enough. There's something called the Senior Executive Service. That's the real deep state. One of my neighbors, she went to work in Washington, D.C., during the Eisenhower administration, and she came home and retired about 10 years ago. And that's a senior executive service. Once these people get there, they never leave. They look at presidents and vice presidents as temporary hired help.
Mm-hmm.
They come and go every 4 years. That's all, or maybe eight at the most. Where the people that really run the government are there decade after decade after decade.
Mm-hmm.
As I said a moment ago, they simply never leave. So we need 4 years of President Trump. We need 8 years of J.D. Vance. Now, that 12 years is going to put a serious amount of hurt, if we get those 12 years, in the deep state.
I hope so.
Now, the country's largest employer, another segue here, Walmart, has more employees than anybody in the country. They're dropping all the DEI stuff, which...
Good.
That's going to be... followed by many Fortune 500, probably all Fortune 1000 companies, I hope. the DEI has tremendously hurt this country for decades. Mm-hmm. I've known personally men who, for example, an engineer friend of mine, well qualified to be an engineer. People he interviewed with, they said, you know, they were quite frank, quite honest. You're the wrong sex and the wrong race. We can't hire you.
No.
And this is 20 years ago.
No, they were just talking about, they were talking about how DEI, the role that it played in the Los Angeles Fire Department and how funds were being diverted from what they needed to be into DEI programs.
Right, right.
Well, and mass amounts.
The fire chief in Los Angeles is a lesbian. The director and I saw the three top officials in the fire department lined up.
And that was an impressive picture, wasn't it?
Well, the one woman, I'm not sure what her title was, maybe director of training, but she looked like she's morbidly obese to me, being at least 100 pounds overweight.
Yep.
And the fire chief takes pride in hiring more women and more minorities. Now, if I was fire chief of Los Angeles, I would take pride in finding nationwide the biggest, toughest, smartest men I could find that could understand. You know, being a firefighter these days means understanding chemicals, understanding how to safely put these fires out, which is not just using water anymore, how to rescue people in burning buildings. And
they've got to know how to outthink those fires.
Yes.
You know, I mean, they have to outplan the fire. Fires with wind follow certain trends. And it takes an experienced man, an experienced group of men, to take care of that.
Exactly. Now, when I went through basic training, everybody in the U.S. Army had to do this. We had to pair up with a soldier of the same weight. I weighed about 155 pounds at the time, and carry that soldier fireman's carry a quarter mile around a track as fast as you could trot, which I did. It was not a big deal. Everybody did it.
Yep.
There's no exceptions. Everybody did it. Now, when they started integrating women into the Corps, they found out that almost no women can do that. There's some exceptions, and God bless them for being that strong. But almost no woman has the upper body strength to pick up a woman of her equal weight and carry that woman a quarter mile around a track. Now, there's a reason for that. If you're hurt, you're bleeding, if your buddy can't pick you up and carry you back to where you can get medical care, you're going to bleed out and die.
Absolutely. You got to carry him back to where we can get him on that chopper.
And the same thing applies to a firefighter. If a firefighter can't pick up the injured person and get them out of the building, that person's going to die.
That's right. That's right. Bunch of girls aren't necessarily going to be able to do it. And I'm not a male chauvinist, John, by any stretch of the imagination, but there's just some jobs. I'm sorry. John, in combat arms, I was always against having women in combat arms. We didn't have it when I was in. It was early 80s. We didn't have that. The closest they got to us was supply trucks.
Right.
There were some females driving supply trucks. You would see that from time to time. But in combat arms, I was 11 Bravo. There was no women involved in that.
See, I went active duty in 1967. I left the Army in 1970. I was in the 6th Special Forces Group at Bragg. And 1979, I decided I wanted to get a hobby. I'm going to get a fun hobby where I'm going to be doing fun things like rappelling and hanging out with the guys and going on patrols. So I went back into Special Forces for about not quite a year. Then I went back into PSYOPs. And that's where I saw women in the Army for the first time. There were never Army women in the Army except in the medical corps when I was in active duty back in the 60s.
But they had in PSYOPs, they had them?
Yeah, there was women in there.
Okay.
I don't know what happened.
Was it because they were working like with equipment or stuff, or
we weren't considered a combat unit.
Okay.
Although we were in combat, at least in Vietnam, and I don't know how the Army made those decisions, but regardless, we're training the PSYOPs guys, and we're out in the training area, Weldon Springs. And this female sergeant is leading the patrol.
He's hunting Weldon Springs.
Yeah, it's a huge area.
Yeah.
I got a Weldon Springs story for you later, but that's a whole different story. So she's carrying her M16 with her finger stuck out like this. And I said, "Sergeant, what are you doing?" And she says, "Oh, I'm drawing my fingernails."
Oh, my God.
I said, "Oh, okay. You're drawing your fingernails." So,
wow.
I was volunteering. I wanted to have, I was in SIOPS, and it was great guys and great gals. And I volunteered for the SEERS course, and I'm training for it, running and doing sit-ups and push-ups and all that. And then they let me know about a month before I was ready to go that there's no money for the class. So if I want to pay for it myself, I could go, but I didn't have the funds to do that. So I signed up for the air assault school, and I'm doing the same thing. I'm running, doing my push-ups and so forth. And about a month before the class, they say, "Oh, we don't have the money, so you can't go." So about the same time, I had a real estate business going, and I just passed 12 rental units and getting up to 13, 14 rental units. And I wasn't getting out of the Army what I wanted to. I was Soldier of the Year, by the way. They thought so highly of me. I was always the driver for the commander whenever we went to the field. He wanted a real combat soldier with him instead of some guy who'd never seen combat. Right. And I signed out of the unit, but a few years later, we had the first Gulf War, and I called the first sergeant who I dated his wife in high school, and we knew each other. And I said, "Sarge, if you need me, I'll go. I'll sign up right now to go this war with you guys." And he said, "John, it's going to be a chemical battlefield. You want nothing to do with this." I said, "Okay." Almost everybody who went to the first Gulf War is either dead or disabled.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that from? The vaccine. The vaccine they gave all these guys and gals for anthrax.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans that were there, they were in the same conditions that all the Americans were. They didn't get sick.
Yeah.
They didn't get the anthrax vaccine.
Yeah.
So another vaccine raised its ugly head and hurt and killed tens of thousands of Americans for no good reason there, Randy.
Soldiers. I remember in the military, I definitely remember the shots. They had the, it was a gun.
Oh, and well.
I know I got like close to 40. Gun. Yeah. It was like close to 40 vaccines.
Really?
I got eight more vaccines than me and a couple of the guys in my unit in basic got more vaccines than the other guys got.
Well, they increased that. When I was going to Vietnam, I got what they call the overseas shot series, which was six vaccines. Do you know why they stopped using the pneumatic shot machine?
No, I don't. I do know that it used to rip your arm if you squeezed your arm. Man, that thing would rip you.
Well, here's why.
Okay.
What they found out, and this was a handheld device that used air pressure to force the vaccine into the skin without a needle. They found out that the first guy that gave it to him when they're lined up, it drew a little bit of his blood and it injected it to the next guy in line. And that the next guy in line got a little bit of blood from the guy before him. So everybody got a little bit of blood from the guy before him. That's why they stopped using him.
Oh, nice. Yeah, there you go. That's nice, John. That makes my night.
every time you lined up for 40 vaccines, you got a little bit of blood from the guy in front of you.
Oh, man. I do remember this. When we came out of the building, our drill sergeant was standing there, and the first thing he said was, "Drop and give me 20. Now, our arms are like this. We're right. Hurting. He made us drop for push-ups, but I got to tell you, it was the smartest thing to do because the other platoons that didn't drop and do push-ups couldn't move the next morning.
Right, right.
But because we dropped and it was 30 push-ups.
30.
30 push-ups. And we actually, I had to thank the guy the next day, seriously, because at least I could move.
Well,
I remember that.
Man. You went through basic at Fort Leonard Wood?
No, actually, Fort Benning, Georgia, sir.
Fort Benning, gotcha.
Yeah. B-3-1.
Oh. Gotcha. Delta 1-2 for me. Right, it's amazing how these things, how the military training, You know, I do concealed carry training. I've been a concealed carry instructor since the 1980s.
Yeah.
And I did a private class for the president of a local bank and his whole family and a couple of family friends. And the same age I am, and he was a Vietnam vet. He's still alive. And I wanted to demonstrate to the class of how the training becomes part of who you are. So the president of the bank agreed to go along with me, a great guy, friend. And I stood him at the position of attention. He had him do a left face, right face, about face, which he executed perfectly, although he had not done that since the 1970.
It's built in.
It's built in.
It is. Yeah. John, you're absolutely correct. It's funny, if you go to get in a scrap, I remember years after being out of the Army, and I took a job as a bouncer. And I got in trouble because I had been taught hand-to-hand combat.
Right.
And I hurt a couple people as a bouncer. And right. I remember the police waiting for me one night when I came into work, and very nice man. He sat me down. He said, "Look, this is going to be one of the hardest things you've ever done in your life." He said, "But you cannot use what the military taught you on people." he said, "I collapsed a guy's throat. The nerve endings behind the throat, and they had to give him an emergency trach in jail."
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so I was, and when I saw all the cops there when I was coming in, I didn't know it was me, but they had a long talk with me. And after that, I got promoted to manager. So,
all right.
John, they didn't want me fighting anymore.
Well,
but you're right. It becomes instinct. And
that's
I don't
right.
care how many years you got.
Now, I'm going to use that for a segue into something else.
Cool.
We started seeing these photographs of Chinese men, military age, in Mexico or just across the border, illegal aliens. And I noticed that if there was 20 of them, or maybe 40 of them, the 20 of them would be standing at the position of parade rest, which is not a normal way for a man to stand.
No,
the parade rest is the feet about shoulder width apart. The hands are held behind the back, and you're standing erect. A man normally does not stand that way unless he's been trained by the military, does he?
That's right. In fact, you would never see it. You would never see it unless they were military.
Right. And so I see these military-aged men, and they look very physically fit with, and one of the things I look for when this comes to what might be called commandos, special ops, are thick necks. And these guys had thick necks.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So they got thick necks. They're physically fit. They're standing at parade rest. And I'm thinking, these guys are Chinese commandos. That's exactly what they are.
Exactly.
You probably came to the same conclusion, didn't you?
Absolutely, sir. Some of the videos and photographs and different things that I've seen, really, John, really concerned me. We've been invaded, my friend.
Well, we have been. That's for all our listeners. There's tens of thousands of what I'm calling these men commandos, because I think most people understand the word commando.
Mm-hmm.
Commandos, in general, it doesn't matter which military, they're trained and equipped to do two things: kill people and blow things up.
Yep.
That's what they do.
Yep.
Kill people and blow things up. It doesn't matter what army they're in. U.S. Army, Chinese Army, Russian Army, British, French, German. That's what commandos do.
Yes, sir.
And Chinese, they have a very good military. These guys are tough. They're well-trained. They're motivated. They really believe that because Chinese explorers got here before Christopher Columbus, that North America belongs to them. That's what they're taught in their schools, which... That's true. Their Chinese explorers did probably get here before Christopher Columbus, but it's a big so what. And we don't know how many out of the millions of, we got, 15 million illegal aliens, how many thousands of Chinese men, commandos, are here. Is it 10,000? Is it 20,000? Is it more? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
they're
we've discussed that before too, John. How many does it take to really shut down a city?
Well, I'll let you know, since you asked the question. When I was in Special Forces A team is 12 men. You got two men are light weapons, two are heavy weapons, two medics, two radio guys. Typically, one guy for intel, that would be myself, maybe two for intel. And you got your 12 men. split it to 2 6-man teams, or maybe 6 2-man teams, which depending on the object, what you're going after. But let's look at St. Louis, for example. It could be any city. It could be Chicago, Kansas City. It doesn't matter. The critical infrastructure, which would be electric, telecommunications, fresh water, sewage treatment. Typically, and especially at night, there is a chain link fence with a padlock. Almost always, no guard. If the guard's there, he's a rent-a-cop who has no training and maybe a 38 if he's armed at all. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Now, to bring down a city, you need to do what? You need to take down the power grid. You need to knock out the telecommunications. You need to knock out the fresh water, knock out the sewage treatment, maybe the natural gas. All of which can be done with no weapons and no explosives, mm-hmm. just common hardware store tools.
Yep.
No explosives, no weapons.
Yep.
And I'm not divulging a secret here. This is common knowledge within the entire special forces community worldwide. It doesn't matter what country. United States, Canada, England, France, Germany, Russia, China. They all know this. It's not a secret.
Nope.
And you could probably do it without even hurting anybody, since most of these locations are not even guarded.
Yep.
Cut the chain link fence.
You'd be in and out before they even know it.
Exactly. Use your hardware store tools to damage and destroy the infrastructure and be gone and get home in time to have a pizza and a cold beer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not, and that's the terrifying part about what's been going on at our border. That is terrifying when you think about it. And it's terrifying, like John used to be in that. I've been close to that. We understand what military men can do. You say it to the average Joe, and they think, oh, it's just some Mexicans or some Chinese came in. You know, more taxi drivers.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
What's that Mexican gardener going to do to my home? Yeah.
But when you know that they're military, we got a problem. We got a real problem.
Oh, we do.
And John, the scary part is we still don't know the intentions.
Well, we know what the ultimate goal of the Chinese is. I've got a copy of the English translation of the speech by the top Chinese general, their minister of defense. It's 20 years old. And he states the goal, and the goal hasn't changed. The goal is for China to capture the lower 48 for themselves. They're going to call it New China. Russia gets Canada. New China will have no Americans present. They may keep a few ones around that know how to run critical infrastructure, like all the locks and dams on the Mississippi, maybe run the airport infrastructure, things like that. But they're going to kill the rest of us. And the people that do have that knowledge, they'll be killed off as soon as that knowledge is transmitted to other Chinese.
Yeah.
And that's the goal, New China. They say, we need space. We got too many people. We got 1 billion people. We need space for our people.
Yeah.
And they intend to kill us. That's the goal.
I have no doubt. We've got to figure out how. It's got to be stopped.
Well, every American needs to be aware of this. Every American needs to be making plans to protect family members, protect property if that's part of what they need to protect. Mm-hmm. And
protect yourself, protect your neighbors.
Absolutely. And they need training. Owning a firearm does not translate into having expertise with a firearm. You know, Randy, I can walk into any art supply store. $1,000 later, I can have everything I need to be Picasso or Rembrandt. But there's no way. Just because I own the art supplies, there's no way I can do what Rembrandt did or Picasso or any of these other guys. No. I don't have that expertise. I simply don't.
Owning
a rifle does not mean you got the skill of a marksman.
Thank you.
Yeah. It takes training.
Yeah.
Now, I work with Sam Andrews. He's the proprietor of Freedom Center USA, where civilians go, as well as active duty Navy SEALs, mm-hmm. active duty Marine snipers, active duty Army snipers, to get the real training. I got a good Army story for you, Randy. You'd appreciate this. So, I'm with the Army Reserve. It's in the early 1980s. And there was a notice on the bulletin board for the following. Tryouts for the Fort Leonard Wood Rifle Team. And I thought, man, this is great. I can go to Fort Leonard Wood. I can get training from the real marksmen that, are win the contests, and it'll be a lot of fun. I'll get some good training and really enjoy myself. So I sign up for that, and I go down to Fort Leonard Wood. I spend the night in the barracks there. I get up the next morning, and while I'm sitting there having my breakfast, a command sergeant major talks to me a little bit, and then I go out to the range. And so we're doing live fire in front of the instructors. The instructors are coaching us. And I got this M16, and because I was an NRA member, I wasn't a certified instructor yet, but I knew since I was an NRA member that you never, ever put any pressure at all on the sling of an M16 because the rifle's too lightweight and you'll change point of impact. I knew that. So I got the sling loose and I'm doing fire, and this instructor comes up to me and says, oh, young soldier, I'm 30 years old, young trooper, you need to wrap that sling around your bicep like this. And he showed me, of course, I knew how to do that because that's what we do with the M14. And they're still using the same protocols used for an M14, which is the right way to hold an M14 to put pressure on a sling because it's a heavy, full-size battle rifle.
Right.
But I pretended to put pressure on a sling knowing it was the wrong thing to do. And I finished the 2-day training, and I went home and never went back. I figured if these instructors don't even know the most basic thing about an M16, you can't put pressure on the sling because you change the harmonics of the barrel, you change point of impact, I'm not going back, because I knew better than to try to change the Army's rifle team's knowledge. You know, coming in from the outside, I know how the Army works.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm going to walk up to the officer in charge of the rifle team and say, sir, by the way, everything you're doing is wrong.
Yeah, that's what you want to do.
That'll go real far. That'll go real far. Yeah. So I never went back. I knew how the Army worked. And I was so disappointed. And I've told that story live on the radio with my friend Sam Andrews. Sam, have you ever watched any of my shows we've done with Sam?
No, but I have done shows here with Sam.
Okay.
Yeah, a few years ago, but I remember Sam well.
Well, for those who don't know, Remington Firearms, which has been manufacturing firearms since the early part of the 19th century, around 1817, I believe they started, they approached Sam Andrews to take over and run their precision rifle division. So Sam was in St. Louis at the time. They fly out three or four executives from the East Coast to meet Sam in St. Louis, and he spent the day with them. At the end of the day, after Sam finished talking to him, he says, gentlemen, what you've broken, I can't fix. And they left. Sam has won more 1,000-yard matches than any human being, and he builds precision rifles, and he runs a school down there in Lebanon, Missouri, Freedom Center USA, where you... Now, I walked into the precision rifle class having fired expert in the Army with the M16, fired marksman with the M14 under very bad conditions, and with four NRA certifications, rifle, pistol, home defense, and so forth. And, of course, I've been shooting rifles since Eisenhower was president when I started as a boy. So I knew more than most human beings about handling a rifle, cleaning a rifle, and so forth. Well, by noon, Randy, I found out I did not know how to clean a rifle. I did not know how to hold a rifle. I didn't even know how to shoot a rifle. I didn't know how to put it in the safe properly. By noon the next day, I'm shooting 12-inch steel plates 10 football fields away, 1,000 yards. Because I learned how to properly clean my rifle, how to hold the rifle, how to shoot the rifle, and how to hit a 12-inch steel plate from 10 football fields away, which is almost impossible to see with a human naked eye, by the way. You can see something out there, but it's pretty small.
Yeah.
Now, I use that as an example of you go into these classes with an open mind, knowing that you can't possibly know what you're going to find out, knowing that you've paid good money to learn what the teacher has to teach you, the instructors. All the instructors are really good marksman. You don't get to be an instructor unless you are world-class marksman. And just a little background here. A very rich family sued Sam for his real estate there, alleging there was not a proper real estate transaction. This has been, we start the fourth year, I think, this month. And it's going to court this month also. It will finally be settled. We believe in Sam's favor. If not, well, that'll be in the Freedom Center. And Sam will continue building rifles, and life goes on. But we have our, we're praying for the best outcome there for Sam and the Freedom Center, that his world-class training can continue. He's had students from all over the world, literally, largely as a consequence of my radio show, because I have a worldwide audience, my radio show. So Freedom Center is the real deal. He also has world-class training for first aid given by active-duty military instructors. One guy just now leaving the Air Force, I believe, where you can learn things that will save a life if there's a bad wound or bleeding is an issue. Learn how to stop the bleeding and save a life. So hopefully that training will commence once again this spring, and people can go to Freedom Center USA and learn something and have a great time at the same time.
That's good. That's fantastic. I'll keep him in my prayers too. I didn't know he was going through that.
Yeah, it's been a, it's been myself and actually Doug has helped a lot too with raising funds, my show and Doug's show, to help the legal effort, which good legal expertise and is expensive to say the least. And so we've been doing that now for these 3 years, and hopefully it'll be wrapped up when we get back to making the Freedom Center what it could be and should be. All the building projects have been put on hold for the most part at Freedom Center, and we need to conclude that lawsuit and move on from there. Anyway, getting back to the topic of the commandos here, we got Chinese commandos, we commandos from various south of our border countries. We don't, I don't know how many countries myself, but pretty much all of them except El Salvador, I believe. Russians, I've had firsthand experience with the Russians, the Spetsnaz being here. I was told by a confidential informant that there is a group of Russian Spetsnaz in every of the 3,300 counties in the United States, pretending to be Americans, quite successfully, I might add. I've been to, personally been to two of the Spetsnaz locations, one in Texas County, in Bado, B-A-D-O, Missouri. The other is just south of Salem, Missouri. I've personally been to both those locations. I know about where the one is in Crawford County. I haven't traveled there. But Spetsnaz is an eight-letter Russian word, Russian acronym for the Russian Special Forces.
Yeah.
Highly regarded.
Oh, yeah.
By all militaries worldwide. Now, Randy, I don't know if I've had people die on Special Forces training, and if that happens, there's a congressional investigation. It's not expected when it happens. You ever have any of your men die in any of your training operations?
No, sir.
Well, you're fortunate, but it's not expected and not normal for American troops to die in training. Especially not, it's expected and it is normal. Their training is full force, and men die routinely in Spetsnaz training. They're smart, they're tough, and how do you become a Spetsnaz? Well, here's how. The Spetsnaz recruiters go to Russian kindergartens, and they have tests that they give to the five-year-old boys to determine which five-year-old boys, 13 years in the future, will be smart and tough and think that jumping out of an airplane in the middle of the night and killing people is normal. They identify these young men, and they put them to the Spetsnaz kindergarten, where if they're destined to come to the United States, they no longer speak Russian. They learn to speak English.
Absolutely.
Now, a friend of mine, he's from the Czech Republic, was Czechoslovakia when he escaped and came to the United States. I said, Joe, how do you teach a native-born Slavic-speaking person, Russian is a Slavic language, to speak English with the proper neutral accent? He said, John, it's only one way. You start when they're 5 years old. There is no other way. So they're surrounded by English music, English television, English movies, English books, English comic books, English posters. And when they're 18 years old, you can't tell them from a native-born American. You simply can't. That's how good they are. And I've talked about this, so I'm not revealing any secrets. The location near Salem, Missouri, I was driving to my webmaster's home just south of Salem. I'm about half a mile south of the city limits of Blacktop Road, and I see the side of a hill being dug out. This is about 10 years ago. I get to my webmaster's home, and he was a Navy veteran. I said, Tim, what the hell's going on? I said, man, I don't know, but they've dug out a lot of dirt on the side of that hill. So they finished the building. It's probably 5,000 or 6,000 square feet. Our friend Tim, he's now deceased, he walks up and knocks on the door, and he says, is this the church I heard was being built? And they said, no. We're a movie production company. Now, this is where it gets better, Randy. Now, if you want to have a good cover story, a cover story will stand up to scrutiny, and you want to shoot machine guns at the local pistol range a lot, you become a movie production company. And that's what they did. They're at the local pistol range with submachine guns every day. This is a couple of winters ago. I don't know if they're still doing it or not. I don't have a local source anymore. With their submachine guns. Just having a great time.
Amazing. Amazing.
Now, the other location in Bethel, Missouri, they're not pretending to be Americans. They're openly Russian. And the story there is the leader, CEO of a Russian alcohol and drug rehabilitation outfit in St. Petersburg is on a cross-country trip going from where he was out west to Florida, going through Texas County. Now, there's no interstate highways going through Texas County, by the way. And he's looking around and he's thinking, man, this is so beautiful. I think I'll move my alcohol and drug rehabilitation outfit from St. Petersburg, Russia, to Texas County. So what does he do? He buys his parcel of land in this ghost town. Bethel, Missouri is used to be a community maybe 50 or 60 years ago. Now it's just a bunch of rundown houses, no store, no post office, no gas station. But it just happens to be about 25 or 30 miles south of the south gate of Fort Leavenworth in Texas County. Oh, yeah. You can see YouTube videos of these guys harvesting apples and doing other work around the project there. I know the place is being monitored. I won't mention anything beyond that, but the place is being monitored by the people who need to monitor it.
Yeah.
There's high-end vehicles like nice new Mercedes and Cadillac SUVs coming and going all the time. If a member of the outfit goes to the local hardware store and they don't have enough money on the debit card, they make a phone call. The debit card instantly has the money they need to buy whatever they need. Now, a question, Randy. Now, I don't know about Russian alcohol and drug rehabs, but Americans typically run a pretty tight budget, don't they?
Absolutely.
Well, why in the world would you move your alcohol and drug rehab outfit from St. Petersburg, Russia, 12 time zones away to Texas County, Missouri? What sense does that make? Seriously.
What sense
does that make?
It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, but I'm sure there's something to it.
A friend of mine, there's a video of an interview with him on my website, Command Sergeant Major Dan Page. He says, John, I've looked at these videos. He said, I can pick out the Sputznuts in amongst the rest of the guys. I can pick them out. Now, he has that training as a Command Sergeant Major. I don't have that training, but he says he could do it, and I don't doubt it for a moment. Now, I've been told, and I haven't confirmed this, that they've now brought in Russian women. I guess these guys were getting really lonely, and they didn't want them consorting with the local American girls because that could be a massive mistake for a lot of reasons.
Oh, yeah.
So I think they brought in Russian girls to help keep the men happy, I guess you could say.
Wow.
So,
people don't even realize this is going on in our country.
No.
That's the bad part.
They don't. It's all subversion.
Yeah.
One of my listeners attempted to notify the sheriff of Texas County, the state police, and they thought he was a nutcase and said, you go away, leave us alone. But there's other Russian enclaves that are up in the open. Just north of Branson, Missouri, is a little town called Ozark, Missouri. Mm-hmm. Little country town. There's a Russian enclave there. They're not secret about who they are. Maybe 20 or 30 families. I don't know how many there are. They're openly Russian, living their lives as Russians. And I'm sure there's other enclaves around the country of a similar nature where there's eight or 10 or a dozen or 20 Russian families living their lives. I'm aware of another one. I haven't really looked it up in another county in Missouri. I haven't had the desire to do so. I've found enough to satisfy me that what my private contact told me is absolutely accurate, that there's Russian Spetsnaz in every county in the entire country. We have about 3,300 counties in the United States, by the way.
That is scary.
It is scary.
That is very scary when you say it like that. Wow.
So what's the mission statement of Russian Spetsnaz? To kill people and blow things up.
Absolutely.
Both of which are very well.
And they're good at it.
Who would they kill? That's the question. Well, anybody who has in a leadership position or has the ability to lead, that would be obviously judges, pastors at churches, any police officers, especially sheriffs or chiefs of police, leader of the community, like a man who might own a company with 100 employees or so.
A mayor.
Anybody who would be looked at as a leader or who could be a leader, there'd be guys in the local, maybe the commander of the VFW or the American Legion would be looked at as a leader.
Yeah.
They'd be the first people to be on the list, wouldn't they?
Absolutely. They want to eliminate anybody that can get a group together and defy them.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they would do that.
Yep.
Now, there was a meeting in Chicago. It's been about 4 years ago. I was confirming through two independent sources that don't know each other, which is very important in journalism or the intelligence field, either one, that representatives from every country except El Salvador traveled to Chicago to have a meeting. Our best efforts of the FBI and the CIA were not able to get listening devices in there. We believe there was two subjects discussed, no more than two, maybe only one, but the two topics being how to split up the drug trade and the money from the drug trade, and the other, how to split up the booty from conquering the United States. We don't believe there was a third topic. And they were able to cross our border. Most of them came up in luxury motor coaches. Some may have flied, I don't know, but I think the majority came up in motor coaches. And it's very concerning to know that this meeting took place, what the possible two topics were, and that we weren't able to penetrate it with our best efforts. The KGB, which is now called the FSU, I believe, has very smart men and women working for them, and with great technology, and they know how to all the countermeasures to keep a meeting like that secret, when they did keep it secret.
Yeah.
Of course, Chicago has been the center hub for communists for decades, hasn't it?
Yep. It's pretty scary when you start talking about it. Absolutely.
Well, it is.
And what's scarier is that they could even have a meeting like that and get away with it.
Yeah, well, they did. And the fact it took place doesn't surprise me, because they had a communist mayor there, and the police were paid off, I'm sure, and the feds just simply weren't able to penetrate and get any recordings. But Donald Trump poses a threat to everything the communists want to accomplish, the Chinese, the Russians, everybody south of our border. He poses a threat to all of that. And the same people are willing to kill millions with the COVID clot shot, are willing to kill whatever and do whatever it takes, kill people, destroy property to accomplish their goals, aren't they, Randy?
Absolutely. And we should be very concerned about that.
Well, we should be. And I don't, I've met some of Trump's people. I've never met the president personally. I was offered to take over the only brick and mortar Trump office in the 2016 campaign. And I was ready to do that when the COVID hit and knocked out all the funding for it. So that was, but in the meantime, I met some of the Trump's people. And I don't know what he's aware of. I hope he's aware of this, very likely. He may be. I met General Flynn and talked to him one-on-one in Oklahoma earlier this year at a conference I was at. I would love to see General Flynn be part of the administration again, but I don't see that happening right now. Maybe that'll change. But there's two things that the powers that be were fearful of when Donald Trump took office in 2016. Two men, I should say. Bobby Kennedy Jr. and General Flynn. They feared those two men the most. They wanted them gone in the worst way, and they had them both gone in less than 2 months.
Yep.
What they did to General Flynn was an absolute travesty, an absolute crime to set him up, and it cost him dearly. It cost the family fortune was spent. They finally got him to plead guilty because they threatened to come after his son, who was active duty military. Well, finally he got this lawyer that took care of it and got him out of all that mess. The woman lawyer, I'm blanking out her name right now. I spent an hour talking to her also down in Dallas. Recall her name offhand?
No, sir.
The female lawyer. Well, maybe I'll remember it later. But, and Bobby Kennedy was going to do the same thing that first time in 2016 that he will be doing beginning in 10 days. Putting the heavy whammo on the pharmaceutical industry, the vaccine industry, the processed food industry, all of which have big bucks and a lot of power. That lawyer was Sidney Powell, by the way. Sidney Powell. And she's won more cases in front of the Supreme Court than any attorney in the last 200 years. Brilliant woman. In my career, I've probably worked with between 200 and 300 lawyers. And this woman's intellect is off the charts crazy. Oh. And I enjoyed my time talking with her. She just published her new book back then. This is about 3 or 4 years ago. And I would love to see her in a position in the administration also. She's the real deal when it comes to intellect and legal talent.
That's good. He needs to surround himself with good people.
Well, he has. Now, President Trump has admitted publicly that one of the big mistakes he made the first time was following the advice of the lobbyists when it came to picking his cabinet choices. He knows that he made a mistake then. Excuse me. Well, he's taken that mistake to heart, and he knows not to do it again. To achieve the success that President Trump did in New York City, building buildings, he had to deal with corrupt city officials, the mafia, the bankers, the building contractors, the unions. He had to satisfy and deal with all these people. And President Trump is a smart, tough guy on one hand. On the other, he came into Washington, D.C. way too naive, trusting people that shouldn't be trusted.
He came in as a regular guy into a politician's world, and a politician, you got to have a certain degree of snake in you.
Well, that's a good observation. I think there's some truth to that, Randy. Yeah. And he was in over his head, quite frankly. Despite how tough he was, how smart he was, how much expertise, it wasn't easily transferable to that world, was it?
No, not at all. And they hated him for it. Well, they hated him too because he's not part of this globalist thing.
No.
He has no intention of participating. Even when they invited him to Davos, he told them he had no intention of being involved with it. I mean, he stood them. He has numerous times. United Nations, he's very clear. United States will never be a socialist country. I mean, he's laid it down.
He has. Well, Donald Trump is a lot of things. I sat across from two older Baptist preachers who said, well, he's not perfect, but God picked him for this job.
Absolutely. And God chooses imperfect vessels.
He does. And Donald Trump's a lot of things, but he's a family man with children, adult children, and grandchildren. Maybe great-grandchildren before too long. I don't know about that.
And he's got a good heart, John. He does have a good heart. I read about an incident where he had a flat tire. And he had gotten out of the car, and he was going to mess around with the tire and all. And this guy stopped and changed Donald Trump's tire for him. And it wasn't about being Donald Trump. But the guy stops, changed the tire, and then Trump, what does he do? He turns around and pays off the guy's mortgage. You know, that's the kind of guy this guy is.
Right,
If he reads about, you know, family loses their houses and they're standing out in the driveway in their pajamas, they got nothing. He's the guy that sends somebody down there to take care of it. He's a good man. He has a good heart. That's why I voted for him. I'm absentee ballot. I voted for him. Okay, that's
well, good for you.
No ifs, ands, or buts. And if he called me tomorrow and said, I need your help, I'd give it to him. Whatever I had.
It reminds me of Sam Walton would go to the loading dock with a box of donuts and a bunch of cups of coffee, mm-hmm. and he'd sit and talk to the guys loading and unloading trucks, the truck drivers, and get to know what was really going on with his corporation by talking to the guys that actually knew what was going on, as opposed to executives who were, quite frankly, guessing what was going on. Yeah. And that kind of...
If you ask a division manager, you don't get a right answer.
Well, he'll give you the answer he thinks you want to hear is what you'll
Absolutely.
Get.
Absolutely. But Sam Walton was a hell of a guy. I read about him leaving his house. He was speeding. He got pulled over. Cop walks up, looks in the car, realizes it's Sam Walton.
Right.
He's like, sir, I'm sorry. And Sam Walton said, wouldn't you give anybody else a ticket? And the cop said, yeah. He says, then you'll give me a ticket.
Right.
I broke the law.
Right. Well, Sam Walton's children are not Sam Walton, are they?
No, not even close, John. Not even close. They're disgusting.
Yep.
They're in bed with the Chinese, like Joe Biden's in bed with the Chinese.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely.
I've read many, many things about the Walton family since Sam died, and I haven't ever read anything that was good. I'm not making that up.
Well, what little bit I know about them is not good either, but we'll leave that for the time being.
Yeah. We could do a whole show just about that. Okay, buddy? I'm having the same thing. I've been fighting with a scratchy throat all night. But like I said, we could do a whole show on the Walton family and where they've gone south. Sam Walton would not be happy with what he has going on today in his family.
Well, I don't have that much detailed knowledge of the Walton family, but like I said, what little bit I have heard has not been very positive. Let's get back to President Trump. He's a family man. He's a smart guy. He's a tough guy. The intro that Doug is using, I use the same footage of President Trump being shot in the head and raising up with his fist above his head, yelling, fight, fight, fight.
Yep.
Now, Randy, I spent a lot of my adult life around what might be called alpha male warriors in the military with special forces and in the private sector. And if there's anything as such as an alpha male warrior, that's Donald Trump, in my opinion. What do you think?
I absolutely agree. He is definitely an alpha male.
I mean, there's a statue. It's going to be shown publicly. It was already some video of it, about a 12-foot statue of Donald Trump with his fist raised.
Yep.
And it's only Donald Trump. They don't have the Secret Service surrounding him, including that woman who wasn't big enough to be there, but that's a whole different story.
Yeah, she was sure leaving him open for a chest shot.
Well, it made a better photograph,
For a frontal shot? That was my concern when I saw her. She wasn't tall enough to really protect the subject.
Well, she wasn't even Secret Service. She was from the Homeland Division. I think, watched a video, an hour and a half video, which is poor quality, before she got that assignment. Well, Dan Bongino has been doing a great job tearing apart what happened at Butler, Pennsylvania. Oh, by the way, in case you don't know it, Sam Andrews has been called to be a witness before a Butler, Pennsylvania grand jury about his expertise of what he observed that day. I don't know when that's going to happen. Grand juries never happen very quickly, but he has accepted that assignment, and I'm sure his expertise will add to the whole story up there. But that woman had no business being on the security detail for President Trump.
No.
But her being so short did make a better photograph, didn't it?
Yeah, it sure did.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, when they get that Butler thing sorted out, Doug and I went out there, and various people, Eric's been out there. There's just a lot of inconsistencies. There's a lot of things that don't make sense. There's a lot of questions still, John. There's a lot. And they have to sort it out. They have to get this sorted out, because the network that organized that and pulled that kid in is still out there.
Of course.
And as long as they're out there, John, President Trump's in danger.
Absolutely. Well, Dan Bongino has expressed his concern about the inauguration a week from Monday.
Yes, sir.
I share his concern.
He's talking about the rally, basically, open-air rally.
The rally is on Sunday, I believe, 2 days before.
I say no to
or
I
a
say
day
no.
before.
I think the rally is foolish myself.
Well, what's the point of the rally? He's not going to, you know, he's not going to run for office anymore. Right? I'm not sure what the
purpose
is.
You won. We don't need a rally. He needs to play it cool until some pieces fall in place.
Well, until the Secret Service is reorganized, I don't trust him. Can you trust him with what happened in Florida, what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania, and other places we probably don't know of?
I know I've been through Butler videos, and I'm going to safely say 40 different ones. From various people on the ground, just all over from that day. And it's amazing at some of the things I've seen. It blows me away, John. Some of the things that I've seen behind the scenes. I'm just stunned, like, what?
You're talking about the actions or lack thereof of the Secret Service?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
The cops, the people that, there were people that might have worked at that building next door that were out on the property, and there was just a lot of strange things going on. One kid that had really a lot of good footage suddenly vanished.
Really?
That kid just vanished. I can't think of his name. He was on, we were seeing a lot of them on Twitter posting videos, and he had a lot of videos that other people didn't have from behind the scenes with the police officers. Right. And all of a sudden that kid was gone. I have no idea what happened to him.
Really?
I say the FBI took him into custody or something, because he vanished, and that kid had some of the best videos that I was able to watch.
Well, are the videos still available?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Doug and I have quite a few of them.
Okay. Well, you guys live in Douglas in Pennsylvania, and you came down for the event, obviously, look it over.
Well, we came down afterwards, and I was down there for a couple of weeks, and anyway, right. Doug and I went out there 3 or 4 days, and it was interesting.
Was the grounds easily accessible? There weren't any fences or gates or anything?
They actually, the first day that we went there, they were having some sort of congressional walkthrough.
Oh, really?
Of some weird thing. We had, we left the one area because the cop wasn't going to let us in. So we turned around and we were leaving, and Doug and I went to the other side of the property. And we were driving along, and all of a sudden, Doug says, "We got a tail." I looked back there, and I was like, "Yeah, two guys in a pickup truck tailing us." So we made we quickly made a right down the side road, went on down, and went to the back gate of that property, those fairgrounds. Uh-huh. These guys pulled up, and they stayed back about 60 yards.
Right.
And they stayed in the truck, and they wouldn't get out of the truck. And we were sitting there, and we're back here, it's deserted back here, there's nobody back here except us and Jug's vehicle and our dog, my dog Ranger, Big Shepherd, and these two guys in the truck. And I was like, I don't know, are we gonna have a problem here, Doug? We're gonna have to, what's this gonna come down to? These guys were acting very spooky, John. Very spooky. Doug pulled forward, circled around like maybe he was going to go at him, and then they took off.
Right.
But it was there for a while. Hair was standing up.
I bet.
It was quite interesting. Because these guys, these weren't cops, man. There's something else going on. There was something else going on.
Well,
and they didn't want us there at the back of the property. They didn't want us there.
My first guess would be FBI, but we don't know, do we?
Hard to say, my friend. Hard to say. All I know is if they got out of the truck, it would have got nasty very fast.
Mm-hmm.
We were ready for them. We just didn't know where this was going to go.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We did that.
Doug never mentioned that.
Well, we went back down a couple times. We went down in the area where the kid, Crooks, where he lived. And we went until we talked to neighbors. I went and talked to a pizza parlor owner who they had misrepresented in a magazine and said, you know, this and that about her. And I went in and ordered some wings and sat there and chatted with her. And she just opened right up and started talking.
Right.
And
we were
finding more and more people were just making stuff up.
Really?
Because when we cross-checked it, John, it wasn't facts. It wasn't mired in facts.
Right.
So, and I'm afraid the whole thing is
buried. You know, making stuff up about crooks is what was going on?
Yes. Yes. Okay. And just, it just seemed like every time we turned around, there was another anomaly. You know, and it was just getting kind of strange.
Well, the grand jury might want some testimony from you guys.
You never know, because there was a subject, without getting into it, who's alive and who's dead. And I'm sorry, Doug Hagman is my friend. He's been my friend for over 20 years. If he says he saw somebody and they were still breathing, then you know what? I leave it at that.
Right.
That's what my friend says. And I've known him, and I wouldn't question his word. And if he says he saw him, end of story. He saw him.
Absolutely. Well, interesting experience you guys had that day, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Are you finishing really, into
it,
the...
It was really interesting because Doug also works with an organization, the guy Shatter Ops. And these guys are phenomenal, you know, in research and things like that, and geofencing and stuff. John, I didn't know anything about geofencing until Doug introduced me. And it's just stunning the stuff that we turned up. It really is. You know, and I hope Doug writes it down in a book one day. I really do.
Well, he's working on a book right now, I understand. And are you finished looking into Butler, Pennsylvania? Is that ongoing?
I don't know. I think that we've still got a lot to uncover.
Really? Okay.
Well, some of it's just going to take time.
Well, every murder investigation I ever did took at least a year. So
it's not like where it's like TV where it's over in an hour.
No, it's a year of my life. And, you know, the cops typically wrap it up in a couple of weeks, but for the defense investigator, it's always a year or more. And
that's to make sure the right guy goes to jail. Because the cops, too many times it's political pressure. The captain walks in the room and says, I want somebody in jail by Wednesday. And guess what? They go grab some slob off the street, set up some evidence, stick them in jail. You know, there's too many cases of that. We've seen that. You've seen it.
I've proven men innocent of murder they were charged with. So,
and John, that is outstanding that you do and that you did, because there's not a lot of men out there like you that would do that. And it's hard to do.
You have to have the right attitude. I get a murder case or any criminal case, I'm just a bulldog. I don't quit. I just don't quit.
Right.
That's what I'd
love to come down and hang out with you sometime, just for a couple of days doing something, because you got some great stories, man.
Yeah, well, Doug's been back and forth near me a couple of times, going back and forth to Branson. I'll be speaking in Dallas. I don't have a date yet with Hear the Watchman. The Red Pill University will have an event. I hope it's in person. The last one I did was online, which I don't really care that much for. But that's Ed Griffin's outfit, Red Pill University. I'll be speaking at that. That could be almost anywhere.
That would be fun to come down to Texas and do something like that.
Yeah.
While I've got everybody here, Wednesday night, I had to cancel show at the last minute. At a medical emergency. I had medical personnel off to my house. Things have been a little scurry lately. I will be gone at least the month of February because I am having my left foot and part of my left leg amputated.
Oh, man.
Just so you know. I'll ask for everybody's prayers in advance.
Well, God bless you. Yes, we'll be praying for you, Randy. Oh,
that's a hard decision to make, but it was a decision that had to be made. And like I said, I'll be gone. You can bank on all of February. Maybe I'm gone possibly somewhat into March. But it's going to be very trying times at the Taylor household for some time. But I just wanted everybody to know that I wouldn't miss a show for anything. And Wednesday, I didn't have any choice. I have a foot that's been giving me problems, diabetic condition, and you know, it's, I don't want it to get infected again and kill me. It's almost killed me two or three times.
Well, hang in there, and we'll be praying for your quick and healing and recovery there. My goodness.
Yeah, I just wanted to, we've kept it pretty close to the belt, but it's to the point, you know, it's going to be hard to explain my absence without telling everybody. I'll ask everybody to please keep me in your prayers. Keep my family in your prayers.
Are you dealing with the Canadian healthcare system or the United States?
On this one, I'll be dealing with Canadian.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I have an excellent surgeon.
Okay, well, if you're satisfied with it, I guess that's all that matters.
In this particular case, I kind of have to.
Okay.
But this gentleman, trust me, I've talked to four or five people over the last 3 years, and I'm comfortable with this gentleman. He knows what he's doing.
Well, that's important. If you're comfortable with him, God bless you.
It's going to be a tough road to recover. It's the first part of February.
Okay, first part of February. So we're looking at about 4 or 5 weeks away.
About 3 weeks, yeah.
3 weeks, that's close. Damn. Well, hang in there, Randy. I had no idea.
I will. I'm a tough old bastard. We didn't get where we're at by being pansies.
No, that's true. That's true. Absolutely. My goodness. Well, Doug will be back in the saddle in a couple of days, I expect, won't
he? Yeah, he should. There's been some strange flus and pneumonias going around. Pneumonia that's easily... I hit it when I had surgery about 3 weeks ago on that foot, and that's what ended up going back on south. But I got sick at the hospital.
Really?
The day of surgery. And I came home with pneumonia, and it was really bad because I've been taking antibiotics for 3 years.
Right, right.
And so guess what? When you're on maximum antibiotics, they can't give you antibiotics.
Right, right.
So I'm sitting there with pneumonia, can't do antibiotics. I got to go to puffers and this and that and the other and vitamins and just old-fashioned vaporizer and rest. And I was so glad. Yeah, people didn't really realize it because I would like dope up before the shows right around Christmas, a couple of days before Christmas and Monday after Christmas. I was so doped on those shows, it wasn't even funny. But if I didn't, I couldn't have done those shows. I was wiped out. Okay. So I know what Doug's going through. I was lucky enough, we had enough days off. Not doing the show to where I could. There were days, John, I slept for 24 hours.
No kidding.
Yeah, so yeah. I know what he's going through. And pray for him, ladies and gentlemen, please pray for him. He's feeling better, but he's not out of the woods yet. But he's a tough, that's a tough old fart, okay? Don't think he's not.
Right. Well, of course he is.
Yep.
That's what he is, obviously.
Yep.
Well, we're down to about the last 8 minutes here, Randy. We've covered a lot of territory. I want to remind everybody that ultimately what we're dealing with is a spiritual war. Mm-hmm. We talk about this, we talk about that, but ultimately it's a spiritual war. And we need to keep that in mind, keep it in focus, that we know who wins in the end. But between here and there, there's going to be a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth. Mm-hmm. People hurt, people killed, property destroyed. It doesn't mean we don't win, but it means it's going to be tough. And your walk with our Lord Jesus Christ is what will keep you going, that will preserve life and limb. And don't forget that. It needs to be foremost in your mind to get through what we're looking at here with the Chinese, the Russians, all the rest of them, the communists, all this woke agenda, which is quickly going away, hopefully. We need to keep in mind that this is a spiritual battle. And if we can do that, I think we have a much greater chance of coming out ahead. Don't you, Randy?
Absolutely. The only way we're going to come out ahead, and we've talked about this many times, complacency is not the answer.
No.
Complacency
has got where we are.
Thank you. And thank you, John, for saying that. This is exactly why we're in the mess we're in. We got complacent as Christians. We got, and it's, and I blame myself and Christians. We got too complacent. I am angry with pastors around the country that aren't leaders in the church and aren't leading the flock how the flock needs to be led in troubled times.
That's right.
You know, and that's where I get so upset with people like, well, it's
well these pastors, it's the they feel like they're running a, right. These it's pastors, the many of them feel like they're running a business.
Yeah.
Anything that jeopardizes the collection plate will not be tolerated. That's the way many of them think and many of them believe. And that's unfortunate truth in many churches.
Yep.
But I go to a little country church in Viburnum, Missouri. Our pastor preaches from the Bible. He's the real deal. And there's still lots of good pastors out there. Mm-hmm. You need to do a little homework and find them, don't you, Randy?
I grew up in Baptist churches. Independent
me
Baptist
too.
Churches. And
me too.
When the pastors would talk Sunday morning, I swear they must have followed me around Saturday night because they knew everything I did.
Yeah.
And they were such great pastors. When they would talk, you were like, I think he's talking to me. You know,
right.
I mean,
right.
It was amazing. And but they were pastors. And like when they raised their hands and they prayed, and you knew they had a personal relationship with the Lord Jesus. You
That's
knew
right.
it. You felt it. I had one pray over
no
me
doubt.
When I was dying of pneumonia as a 6-year-old kid. And I remember when he touched my leg and started praying, I felt like electricity went through my body.
No kidding.
And I came back from heaven's door because they said later I was talking about angels and I was dying.
Really?
Yeah, I almost died.
No kidding.
And all I remember is him touching my leg, and I don't remember much else. But that man, when he was in the room, you knew that man knew the Lord Jesus. You knew it.
Absolutely.
Man.
Well, when I was laying on the ground during the Tet Offensive and the mortars were hitting around me, I was praying, and I said, Lord, you let me live through this. I'll do important things with important consequences. I don't know what it'll be. Just let me live through this, and I'll do important. I'll do important things with important consequences.
We'll work out the details later, Lord.
Yeah, just let me get me through this.
Like I said, there's no atheists in foxholes.
You know, they don't teach you in basic training that when the Cobra gunship is doing a gun run over you, that those shell casings are really hot, that you need to keep your collar tight so the shell casings don't go on the back of your neck.
Oh,
yeah.
Some nice 30-millimeter rounds dropping down your
Well, they were 7.62 machine gun rounds about the Cobras, but they were still hot. They're still hot. And, yeah, I learned firsthand, keep your shirt tight so you don't get your back burned up by the shell casings. Randy, I want to thank you for being with me and doing this show. And we are hoping that and praying that you will, your surgery will get exactly the outcome you're looking for, that your recovery will be a rapid and great recovery, and that you can be back with Doug back in the saddle as soon as possible, sir.
As soon as I can get back on, I will, believe me. And I'll appreciate everybody praying. I'll thank you in advance. You guys have pulled me through many things before. And one of the reasons I'm doing the amputation is I feel the Lord's calling me for things that I can't do from a wheelchair.
Right, right.
And this will give me my mobility back. And I've prayed about it, and I feel this was the answer. This is the kind of that's the conclusion I came to.
Well, Randy, we wish you luck. We'll be praying for you. We'll be praying for Doug to be back in the saddle this coming Monday.
Right.
And yes, it's been a good show. We covered a lot of territory, and
it's just good to see you again, man. I haven't seen you in a while.
It's been a while. It's been a while, but maybe we can do this more frequently, Doug and I, and you as you can.
Absolutely,
that'd be great. Well, thank you, sir. Have a wonderful evening, and we'll be praying for your surgery, your doctor's hands to be guided by our Lord, and a rapid recovery, sir.
And ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you for your support.
Absolutely.